We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, while most of you potentially were watching the second day of the RNC last night, if you were watching, Governor Ron DeSantis gave just a barnstormer speech. It was excellent. Brought down the House. Vivek Ramaswamy also on stage. Nikki Haley was invited and gave a full-throated endorsement of Donald Trump. I mean, politics is just wild, where she can basically say a couple of months ago that Donald Trump is the greatest threat to democracy, and then, you know, be invited back to the party and then get on the stage and say, yeah, no, we disagree here and there, but, you know, it's all good. So while that was all going on, President Joe Biden apparently had a Zoom call because he probably can't meet anybody in person. And I'm sure this was before 8 p.m. last night. So he's looking, though, I mean, in all seriousness, this is actually a really serious story, because he's looking to drastically change the U.S. Supreme Court. The Democrats have been saying this for years, and particularly after Donald Trump put his three nominees on the U.S. Supreme Court. But Biden has historically kind of resisted some of the more dramatic expressions from the AOC and squads of his party. But he is now actually finalizing plans to endorse major changes to the U.S. Supreme Court in coming weeks. This coming from the Washington Post this morning, including proposals for legislation to establish term limits for the justices and an enforceable ethics code. We've heard a lot about that in the wake, of course, of all of these attacks against specifically Justices Alito and Thomas. And then Washington Post goes on to say he, Joe Biden, is also weighing whether to call for a constitutional amendment to eliminate broad immunity for presidents and other constitutional office holders. Speaking on some of these people on the Zoom call were speaking to the Washington Post on the condition of anonymity to discuss the private deliberations. The announcement marks a major shift for Biden, the former chair. A former chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who has resisted calls to reform the high court. He previewed that shift in a Zoom call. And this, of course, is directly going to attack the presidential immunity case and a number of other things that the originalist wing of the court and the what we would say are the more conservative justices. So we are joined this morning by Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel at the Lawfare Project and an attorney fighting for civil rights. And you can follow him on X at Gerard Folletti. And so good morning, Gerard. And, you know, what do you think of this proposal?
Good morning. Well, I think first we need to see this proposal for what it is. And this is a campaign stunt. It's not something meaningful that can actually get passed into law anytime soon. Because what Joe Biden wants, which essentially is to adopt an ethics code for the Supreme Court, to put term limits on people, on the justices of the Supreme Court, and then a constitutional amendment about presidential immunity and other immunity, that requires him to have control of both houses of Congress and the White House. And even then, it'll be difficult to pass. So let's see this for what it is. He is responsive now to the fact that the Republicans are having a very successful convention. He needs something in the news to help galvanize his party, and he's grasping at what has recently come out as the Supreme Court decision on immunity and attacking the court as a way to bolster the base. That's what this is about. It's not about meaningful substantive change that can actually be implemented, but it's rather a campaign stunt.
Yeah, and that's such a great point, because this would have to, in order to actually happen, it would have to be legislation that is passed and signed. And then, of course, a constitutional amendment would have to go through that process, which takes quite a lot, thankfully. I mean, we can amend our U.S. Constitution, but it takes a lot to actually get there, and, you know, ratification by the states and all of that. And so does this type of rhetoric really galvanize the base of Democrats? I mean, do they know that this is just a political sort of stump speech, basically, rather than any sort of meaningful, I'm actually going to do this in, you know, the last 7 months of his presidency?
Well, people believe a lot of what they're told these days. And the problem is, a lot of people have forgotten civics and have forgotten how the government works. So when they hear a speech like this or an idea like this, they think that Joe Biden can just sit down, write an executive order and get this done. And that's not how the government works. And I don't think a lot of people, Democrats and Republicans, quite frankly, included, remember this. So this is something that needs to be highlighted, that this is coming at a time when media focus on the Democratic Party is whether or not Joe Biden is fit to be president. It's whether or not the Democrats will survive this election. It's about unity that the Republicans are trying to find. And quite frankly, Joe Biden did give a good speech about toning down the rhetoric and finding unity. But on the other hand, here's what he does. He does something that shows how disunited we are as a country and tries to take aim at the Supreme Court because of decisions he doesn't like, instead of going through the process of actually making good laws or good arguments. And I think a lot of people need to realize that that's what this is. This is politics as usual, and it's not going anywhere. Where it's going to is going to get people out to vote, and it's going to get Republicans out as much as it gets Democrats.
Yeah, and that's a great point as well. And I'm speaking to Gerard Folletti, who is an attorney and senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And the Supreme Court has been really a focal point, I think, for both bases, especially in 2016 and even heading into 2020, even though, yeah, obviously that was a little bit different of a situation. But with the appointments of Donald Trump, but especially in 2016, when we had that vacancy with Justice Scalia's passing. And the Democrats have been very frustrated with the court swinging back a little bit. And obviously, you know, we could parse this out and all that. But overall, having a more conservative majority than they have prior to Donald Trump's administration. And that was a huge reason that a lot of conservatives got out and voted in 2016, is because of the importance of the court. And so the Democrats, not just Joe Biden, but their entire party, I mean, the AOC and the squad, I mean, she's filed this ethics complaint now, you know, against, I think it's Justice Thomas. And, you know, they're just consistently attacking Thomas and Alito because they don't like their opinions. And so they're trying to find anything and put a lot of political pressure on them. So even though this proposal is just political, what does this portend for a post-November landscape in terms of the contrast between a Republican view of what the Supreme Court is and the federal judiciary versus what the Democrats are trying to reshape it in their image?
The irony and perhaps the reality is that no matter who is in power, if the Supreme Court or who you are, if the Supreme Court rules against you, you are going to not like what that opinion is, and many people are going to find it politicized. So this cuts both ways. It's not just Democrats. We've had plenty of years where the Supreme Court seemed very favorable to liberal ideas, and the Republicans were not happy about it. But what this portends is we are going to see continued divisiveness on the role of the judiciary and the powers of the Supreme Court, which is a core issue because it is so important nowadays. We do see government overreach in many ways. We do see Congress not passing detailed laws and leaving interpretation up to government agencies, which come up with very bizarre regulations sometimes that hurt the economy and hurt the American people. So what we do with the judiciary counts. And this issue is not going away. Joe Biden may not be able to sign away the powers of the Supreme Court, but this is something that Democrats will actively be strategizing about for years to come. How do you mitigate the power of the court? In the old days, it used to be that you went back to Congress and you drafted proper legislation that was actually constitutional and sound. Sometimes you didn't get everything you wanted because your ideas were too out there, but you would redo the law and have it pass constitutional muster. Now we're looking at destroying the institutions of government instead of doing that. And that's not to say that Democrats want to destroy all institutions of government, but they sure seem fixated on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right that it is a both sides kind of view. And of course, it shouldn't just be that in an originalist view, and it's not that Republicans somehow win all the time or that Democrats lose all the time. This should be an independent judiciary that actually looks at the rule of law and applies the law to the issues of fact in the cases. And so with this call, especially for a code of ethics. This is an interesting debate because the judicial code of conduct does not currently apply to the U.S. Supreme Court. My concern, Gerard Folletti, is that any sort of ethics code that could be written, even if we all agreed on it, which, you know, the Supreme Court already is there for a term of good behavior under Article 3, and so they can be impeached if there's something, you know, wildly inappropriate. But any sort of code of judicial ethics, I think, would just be politicized and weaponized potentially by both sides for a justice that one side or the other didn't prefer.
Of course it would. And when you remember what the standards used to be in professional ethics for lawyers, and still are in some states, it's the appearance of impropriety. So if you have a code of ethics, you're going to see that abused every time a justice, you know, walks down the seat and says hello to someone who might be a political operative. You're going to see an ethics complaint launched every time a justice sits down for dinner with an old friend who might be somehow connected to politics in any way. You'll see an ethics complaint. That's the sort of thing that's going to be used to, or abused rather, to go after the Supreme Court and bog them down and prevent them from doing the business that they're tasked to do, which is to interpret the laws and come out with rulings on cases that are, quite frankly, not that easy. Otherwise, they wouldn't be at the Supreme Court. So that's the consequence of having ethics rules. Yes, you do want them, and yes, you do want to have them enforceable, but you can't draft them in such a way to really tie the hands of justices and make them paranoid from having any contact with humanity out of fear of a complaint being raised.
Right. And we have to remember, I mean, these are people who have friends, they have communities, they have families, and, you know, and their families, as we've learned through this ridiculous political attack against Justice Alito with the, you know, the flying of the flag and all of that with his wife. I mean, the spouses of justices are not bound by the same sorts of ethics rules. And so yet it's just a way to attempt to attack these justices and try to ultimately disconnect them from reality, but and from humanity in their communities, but to target them as a political opponent rather than recognizing that this branch is the one that's intended to be non-political. But in just the last few minutes I have with you here, so, you know, Joe Biden is talking about these reforms, and the right has talked a lot for years, in fact decades, about judicial reform. And so this isn't an issue that's going away. What should we be focused on in terms of good, appropriate judicial reform as a whole, not just specifically to the Supreme Court?
Well, that's such a tough question, because there are so many things that could be done. But the essence is, when you're looking at judicial reform, you have to go back to the basics and see what the role of the courts is. And the role of the courts is not to legislate. It's not to create law. It's to interpret the law. The problem is that we've had activist judges on both sides, activist judges that have taken up issues or taken up cases with an intent to come out with a ruling that will change society. That's not what the law is. That's not what interpreting the law is about. That's the role of Congress. That's the role of the executive. The courts are there to say whether something is sound legally, to say whether something is enforceable. It's not to come up with new ideas or new rules or new policies. And that type of judicial activism really does cut both ways. So if you want to start with reform, it has to be some reform that gets to the heart of that problem, which is keeping justices on track or judges on track to do what they're tasked to do and not to come up with laws. Even looking at Roe v. Wade as an example, that's a problem both with the courts and Congress. You have the U.S. Supreme Court step in and essentially create a law that was never written by the American people or their representatives, because Congress couldn't step up and do something about it, or the states weren't doing enough about it. And that's what we have to change. We have to change the dynamic where courts are creating laws.
Yeah, so well said. Gerard Folletti, really appreciate your time this morning. He is senior counsel for the Lawfare Project. You can follow him at Gerard Folletti, and he's a regular on the Legal Eagle panel on my Salem TV program, Jenna Ellis Tonight, which airs at 9 p.m., and you can also stream that wherever you listen to podcasts, because I know a lot of you listen to this show on podcast as well. But this whole topic just goes back to what we always talk about on this program, which is that we have to be informed. We have to know what our U.S. Constitution says, how our system of government operates, how we understand our truth in community, and which is our definition of politics, so that we can advocate for things that are good and right and appropriate, understanding how the system is designed and what it's intended for, and can have meaningful conversation around judicial reform. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
You know, there are many ways we can impact the world around us. Some are more direct, like helping our neighbors and serving in our churches. Other ways are broad, like becoming community leaders or supporting missions. Of course, taking care of our families is a given. If there was a way to impact all of those at once, would you be interested? The AFA Foundation is a great way to touch your family, your neighbors, and even complete strangers all over the country. You may not realize it, but you can support AFA with a charitable gift annuity, a trust, your will, or a charitable rollover. We realize not everyone knows what those are or how to set them up, but that's okay. Many of your questions can be answered on our website, afafoundation.net. Find answers and resources to help you make an informed decision. And if your decision is to move forward, you can get in touch with Riley, Chelsea, or Jessica to start setting up your legacy. Touch more lives than you imagined possible when you visit afafoundation.net today.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as the nation is still awaiting answers that I think we absolutely deserve of exactly what happened with the assassination attempt of former President Trump at the Butler, Pennsylvania rally just on Saturday. I mean, this hasn't even been a week, and already there are so many different elements that are coming out that just make this whole entire story even more bizarre. And last night, there was a story that came out, according to CNN, and then, of course, has been reported by other outlets. The U.S. authorities had actually received intelligence weeks prior to that rally and that incident from a source about a potential plot orchestrated by Iran to target President Trump. And so the Secret Service apparently and reportedly had actually increased security for Trump after those threats against his life. And so Town Hall is reporting today in yet another revelation that only makes Secret Service brass, namely the agency's director, Kimberly Cheadle, look more caught off guard during Saturday's attempt on former President Donald Trump's life. It turns out the United States Secret Service had actually increased protection for Trump in recent weeks leading up to the rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. Yet the attack still took place. The impetus for what was supposed to be higher security for Trump, intelligence about an Iranian plot to assassinate the former president, CNN cited, quote, multiple people briefed on the matter who told the outlet that American officials had, quote, obtained intelligence from a human source in recent weeks on a plot by Iran to assassinate Donald Trump. That intelligence, the report stated, led to the Secret Service increasing security around the former president in recent weeks. So what transpired on Saturday that took place despite an increase in protection for Trump? And my question is, you know, what were those agents allowing him to do when, I mean, yes, it's an iconic photo. He's raising his fist and, you know, basically signaling to the people there, I'm okay. I mean, if you actually go and watch that video, and I'm sure most of you have by now, if not multiple times, I mean, it's just, it's shocking to watch history unfolding right there. But there are a couple of seconds there after President Trump ducks down behind the podium where you're not really sure if he had been hit and wounded even worse. And then the Secret Service go up on the stage. And when I first watched that, I'm thinking, is he okay? Is there something even worse? But then when he actually gets up and signals to the audience, you know, and that he's okay, that was thankfully, you know, that I think caused less speculation in terms of overall his survival, at least in that moment. But a lot of this is just absolutely wild. So joining me now is a good friend, John Cardillo, who is former NYPD and has been commenting on social media. And you should follow him at John Cardillo on X. Just for a lot of this commentary, Dan Bongino has had some really interesting Rumble shows as well on this. I mean, former law enforcement perspective, I think, is really important here. Representative Corey Mills, who used to be a sniper himself, had a lot of commentary actually on CNN last night, much to their consternation, I think, about some of these questions. So John, thanks so much for joining and providing your analysis based on your experience. Overall, what's your thought right now about this whole situation?
You know, Jenna, I'm glad you mentioned Dan Bongino and Corey Mills. Dan's an old friend. He was NYPD prior to being Secret Service, and I know Corey pretty well. But what I want to say first is, you know, we've known each other a while, you and I, and we've been on social media with typically like-minded. But normally when there's a controversial issue, right, whatever it is politically, we might be in agreement, and then there are going to be thousands of people who are in disagreement with us. You know, the Secret Service's response to this shooting is unique in one way, and it's the first time. I've probably been on X, formerly Twitter, 15 years. I think it is 15 years, 2009, as I'm looking at my laptop right now, is when I joined. I've never engaged in a controversial issue like this where there was 100% unanimous consensus from everyone who's worked in law enforcement or been in the military and worked on or around protective details. No one is disagreeing with one another on the Secret Service's response and actions being abysmal. Dan's commentary has been outstanding. So is Corey's, or Representative Mills. And it's really unique in that all of us agree with one another and are saying exactly the same things. It was that bad.
Yeah, and even the Democrats, I mean, who are no fans of Trump, and we've seen, you know, a lot of, in my view, disgusting rhetoric since Saturday from, you know, some who are not fans of the former president. I mean, disagree all you want politically, but, you know, when we're talking about someone's life, there is no way to justify what happened on Saturday. But even, you know, Joe Biden, who is calling the former president and, you know, the current first lady, you know, Jill Biden, reaching out to Melania. I mean, you know, this is a national event that, if anything, should be unifying the country around this expression that this type of political violence is never appropriate. This is not OK. And we need answers. And so Speaker Mike Johnson, I watched his speech from the RNC last night and it was excellent. He was one of the few that it was actually invoking the name of God. Our rights come from God, our creator, you know, going back to America's founding, not some of this other nonsense that's been platformed. But one of the things that he said, John, was that the House is immediately going to conduct an investigation. Is that the right entity, do you think, of Congress to actually get to the bottom of this?
Yeah, because I don't trust Homeland Security Inspector General or a Secret Service OPR, Office of Professional Review. I absolutely don't trust any agency under Alejandro Mayorkas. We've seen him sit down and lie to Congress, lie to the American people about the border being secure, lie about his deployment of Border Patrol. Secret Service is a sub-agency of the Department of Homeland Security. So Mayorkas ultimately runs the show with regards to those internal investigative agencies, their internal affairs. I think the only way to get even a modicum of accountability is for Republicans in Congress to put them all on the hot seat. That said, the Secret Service director is so useless, and needs to be fired immediately. For no other, but number one, because of the absolute lack of leadership and command and control. What's even worse is that before this woman took that global security job at Pepsi, she was Secret Service for 27 years. In her last assignment, she was an assistant director and the executive officer, the number two, in the unit that trains people for the presidential protective details. She knew exactly what to do, exactly what not to do, but focused so much on diversity and wokeness and all this nonsense that her leadership or lack thereof caused this. And so the mere fact, Jenna, let me say this. It is unheard of that a former president, the nominee of our party, okay, he was the actual nominee a couple of days later, but he was the nominee, and the man who's going to be the 47th president of the United States was shot because of a systemic abysmal failure, and nobody's been fired. So I don't trust Secret Service to both investigate themselves or, to be honest, to Congress. It's that bad.
Yeah, and the Secret Service Director, Kimberly Cheadle, has now come up with this ridiculous excuse about why that rooftop that was just 140 yards away from the stage, why that was allowed to remain unsecured. And this was so ridiculous. She said it would have been too dangerous to put snipers on that roof because it was sloped. I mean, this is beyond it. This is like saying, you know, Biden's abysmal debate failure was due to cough medicine. I mean, this is just wild these people are making these kinds of excuses.
Yeah, he had a stutter, right? Now, look, first of all, she should be fired for that alone. That, you know, I've been analyzing this stuff for a long time, and I know who these people are. I know many of these people, and rarely do I get personally angry. Her statement about the sloped roof was personally infuriating because the counter-sniper team that ultimately took the guy out were positioned on an identically sloped roof. I go to the gym every morning, and the treadmill, I do a 15-degree incline on the treadmill. That roof wasn't even a 15-degree incline. There was nothing unsafe about physically fit SWAT guys because your counter-snipers are always going to be part of your tactical team, SWAT, emergency service unit, whatever it's called in the respective agency. They're laughing at this. I spoke to a couple of guys in Pennsylvania law enforcement. They're like, slope the roof. We practice on roofs with 45-degree pitches. Like, what is this woman out of her mind? But there are 9,000 videos of the counter-sniper team that ultimately killed the bad guy on an identically sloped roof made of identical materials. That one, the woman flat out lied to cover her butt.
Wow. Well. This John Cardillo, so John Cardillo is my guest today. He's former NYPD. You can follow him at John Cardillo. So, you know, this is just so beyond comprehension for a lot of different reasons. But what also do we know now about the Iranian threat and whether or not, you know, that was related to the events on Saturday night? I mean, you know, Corey Mills was suggesting on CNN last night that, you know, he said, I'm just having to follow where the natural questions lead, and asking whether this was intentional in terms of the lack of security by the Secret Service. And CNN got really upset at that. And, you know, she was going, well, who is they? What do you think? And he's like, that's why we need an investigation. But he was saying that this is just such an obvious thing, like it's 101 basic that you would not leave that rooftop unsecured. That, and of course I'm paraphrasing and people should go back and listen to the full interview, but he was basically saying, I mean, I'm just left saying this was just so basic that it had to have been an intentional oversight. Where are you at with that?
Oh, well, I'm not, do I think it was a proactive deep state operation? No, but I will say this, Corey's 100% right. In terms of securing the rooftop being that basic. I mean, I worked alongside the Secret Service with NYPD. It's the first thing you do, right? I was doing Dr. Drew's show last night, Drew Pinsky, and I said it to him in a way, said to him, hey, Drew, I'm going to say this in a way you'll understand as a physician. Not securing the rooftop immediately would be akin to a surgeon not washing their hands before walking into the operating room. It's just not done. Jenna, the Secret Service started protecting presidents in 1901, Teddy Roosevelt's administration. The doctrine of you secure the high ground first has been in place almost as long. It was doctrine when I was there years back. It's been doctrine since the Kennedy assassination. Remember the movie JFK by Oliver Stone? Donald Sutherland's character's in a conversation, and he says, you know, I'll paraphrase, you know, do you really believe they wouldn't secure the high ground? This is just the first thing you do. It's not even debatable. And that particular building was the highest priority. It had the direct line of sight. It was a perfect shooter's perch. You position a team up there. So it is mind-blowing. It's baffling to any of us who worked around this. Now, do I think Iran had anything to do with this one? No. That threat is in place. They've always had a particular disdain for Trump after he took out Soleimani. Trump was one of the few people that understood you got to go after the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. because I had a CIA chief of station tell me people misread the IRGC. The only modern day equivalent to the IRGC, he told me, was Hitler's SS. He said, in every way, they're as brutal, as evil, and as wide-reaching as Hitler's SS. Trump understood that threat, and he reacted very well. Took out Soleimani, one of the worst people in the world. So it's no surprise Iran wants him, but I think this was just a systemic breakdown and incompetence, due in large part, Jenna, to the Secret Service being understaffed and having to fly agents in from other sub-agencies under Homeland Security that didn't have that training that they needed. And you could see that in the choreography of the response. It was a mess. These people clearly never trained together.
Yeah. And we've seen some of these photos coming out that, you know, there's round mocking of some of these agents, which, you know, I mean, is on one hand, I understand it. On the other hand, it's, you know, they are willing to put their life on the line for protection. And so while we can criticize and critique their actions there, you know, a little bit of some of it, I think, is maybe a little bit over the top. But at the same time, you know, in just the last few minutes I have with you, John, one of the questions, though, to me that just sticks out as just really weird, even with all of these breakdowns and all of these things and the Secret Service, you know, not securing this roof, all of this taken together, you have a 20-year-old kid that somehow climbs on that specific roof at this specific rally. I mean, it just seems like there's too much that's a coincidence.
Well, I think it's just an absolute systemic breakdown. I don't think this kid was, this wasn't facilitated by a state actor. I think you had a troubled kid who maybe just hated his parents, his dad bought the gun, we're finding out his parents are Trump supporters, whatever it may be, he climbs up. I mean, the reason we all have the same analysis, me, Bongino, Corey Mills, and everybody else out there who has ever worked in this world, is because we're all kind of speechless when we look at this. I mean, he put up a ladder, but even worse, 26 minutes prior to him firing the shot, civilians, people were saying, there's a guy with a gun. Moments before he fired the shot, a police officer climbed up the roof. He pointed his gun at that cop. I mean, this is just a breakdown, an incredible lack of training. And, you know, let me say this real quick. The agents deserve all the criticism, and I'll tell you why. When I was active, the training in New York City for tactical was abysmal, right? They don't want to spend money. They don't want to give you more range time. We did it ourselves because we understood the job. These are people protecting the former and soon to be, again, president of the United States. It was incumbent upon them to practice, to know what they were doing. That one agent couldn't holster her weapon. I mean, that is inexcusable that she couldn't holster her weapon. So I don't know. I think the critique is deserved.
Yeah. Well, really well said. And John Cardillo, really appreciate your commentary, your expertise. And, you know, I have known John for a while. I've known Dan Bongino for a while. I mean, this is a very close, tight-knit group of people who all know what they're doing. And John is right. They're all saying the same thing. I think we deserve answers to these questions. The American people deserve that. So I'm looking forward to that investigation from Congress. But we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. A recent study reports that the rapidly declining global birth rate will lead to a major population crisis if birth rates continue to decline. Their massive support for Planned Parenthood is all part of their plan. While we may feel hopeless in the constant attack on life, there is an amazing way to fight back. When they shout abortion, we shout life. Preborn is leading the way. Every day, their network rescues 200 babies. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, a baby's chance at life doubles. The ultrasound is the secret weapon that joins a mother's heart to her child. Preborn provides ultrasounds for clinics in the highest abortion areas. Can we join hands nationwide for life? One ultrasound is just $28, but any gift will help. $5,000 will underwrite ultrasounds for an entire network for a day.
All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are in the midst of a huge cultural fight, and this is nothing new, though. This has always been the juxtaposition between the church and God's people and a culture that is godless and is rapidly descending toward even worse and worse evil. And this is why Christians need to be engaged and fight for truth in our culture and be in the business of changing hearts and minds and ultimately bringing people, individuals, into a saving relationship with Him. And that is what the American Family Association, in terms of our ministry, engagement in the culture and being able to bring you each and every day here on all of our programs. And I'm so grateful to be in the morning slot and the first off to be able to talk about truth and to analyze all of what's going on in our society from a biblical worldview, from a truthful standard. And this is why your support is really meaningful to us. And so I want to welcome in Chelsea Wildman, who is the Associate Director for the AFA Foundation, to talk a little bit about the AFA Foundation and also the charitable gift annuity, if you are considering donating to this ministry so that we can continue to be ministers to a lost and fallen world. So, Chelsea, good morning, and thanks so much for joining.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Jenna.
Absolutely. So, so for those who aren't yet aware, what is the AFA Foundation?
Yes, so the AFA Foundation is the financial stewardship branch of the ministry. So we seek to exist to help people set up charitable gift annuities, deal with bequests, wills, that sort of thing. So we are here to help with their long-term planning.
And that's so great. So what are the benefits of a charitable gift annuity? It contrasted perhaps between, you know, one time or a monthly donation that we talk about primarily during Share-a-thon.
Yes, absolutely. So a charitable gift annuity, basically what it is it's a gift to the ministry. Anything $2,000, that's the minimum, so $2,000 and above, and that just is varying and different for each family situation. But you would give a gift to AFA, and in exchange, you would receive fixed income for life. So it's not going to go, your percentage is not going to go up or down with the market. It is based on your date of birth and when you choose to receive the income. So obviously, the sooner you put it in place and any amount of time that you wait to receive that income will be a higher percentage for you. And the benefits, you get a partial tax deduction the year that you give the gift, as well as partial tax-free income when the donor starts to receive those payments. So you get some great tax breaks, and then you also get the benefit of knowing that, you know, when you pass away and go home to be with the Lord, any remaining funds are then gifted to AFA. So it does help us, as you mentioned, in the culture war, and to continue to be here and keep these radio waves full of wonderful programming for America so that we can hopefully win back our culture war.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so grateful to be part of AFA because our only mission is truth and to serve the Lord. And that's so different than a lot of other jobs or positions, even, you know, talking on perhaps other networks that, you know, have that are beholden to certain sponsors or certain perspectives or certain viewpoints and all of that. I love being here because we can just talk about the truth and the things of God. And that's our only standard. And so I'm so grateful for everyone who does contribute to AFA. It's such a blessing to be here in this ministry. And so with the charitable gift annuity, Chelsea, this can be in either a transfer of cash or property. So how does that work?
Yes. So a gift of cash is always the, you know, quickest, easiest transaction. But we also have stock. So and property, as you mentioned. So the stock, you would, whomever had, you know, maybe some appreciated stock that you didn't want to pay all those capital gains on, you can transfer that to our account with the American Family Association. And whatever that stock sells for in the market, that is what your charitable gift annuity is funded with. And we take into account, you know, your cost basis, the capital gains, et cetera. And the capital gains are actually spread out through the life of the annuity, so that is going to help that donor with those gains. You still get a partial tax deduction and partial tax-free income. It's just another way to fund a charitable gift annuity. So a stock is a great way, and we also receive calls for outright stock gifts, you know, not for a charitable gift annuity, but just for a donation. Maybe folks want to, you know, get something out of their portfolio that's not working for them anymore, and we would be glad to talk to them about that. And that would, of course, be 100% tax deductible donation. So those are some great ways. And then property, that minimum of a gift for a charitable gift annuity is $500,000 or more. So the value of the property has to be at least that for us to consider taking that on to fund a charitable gift annuity.
Okay. Wow. And there's so much great information there. And you can go to AFAFoundation.net. And I'm on the website right now. And there's a lot of different tabs. If, you know, this seems like, wow, there's so many options, or I don't exactly know how this works. There is a tab for how to give, what to give, learn about wills, donor stories, a free estate planning guide. So there's a lot there that's just on the website. But you can also contact, and that's AFAFoundation.net. AFAFoundation.net. You can also contact us by emailing foundation@afa.net, or you can call 800-326-4543 at extension 345. So it's 800-326-4543 and extension 345. And I promise you will talk to someone just as lovely as Chelsea, because I haven't met anyone at AFA so far that isn't just so bright and bubbly all the time. And I always love the times I get to go to Tupelo and go to our headquarters and just be around so many of God's people. And so, Chelsea, thanks so much. And how long have you been in this specific area? And is this for you personally something that, you know, that you wanted to take on, you know, this kind of the AFA Foundation side of things, or what drew you to this part of the ministry?
Yes. So I've been at the ministry for 10 years now, and I've loved every minute. Yes, what drew me to the foundation, and I was so thankful when our leaders asked me to kind of transition into that role. At first, I came on with the human resources side. We do have, you know, a great staff. And so I started in that role. And then when leadership asked me to move into the foundation to work with our supporters and be trained by, you know, the late Dan Cilia that has trained Riley and Jessica and I. And now we have Rob West on, and he is a wonderful, you've gotten to meet him many times.
Yes, I love Rob. He's
a
great.
Wonderful. Yes, he's a wonderful leader for the ministry in the financial realm. And so whenever they asked me to transition over there, I was so excited because I get to speak with our supporters and our family one-on-one and really get to know them more and help put in place a plan for them for retirement years, and also, you know, benefit AFA. So it's really a win-win for both. And I'm just so thankful to get to build those relationships within the ministry of our supporter family.
That's so wonderful. And thank you for sharing your personal story. And I just love all of the people in this ministry. And, you know, while it seems sometimes so siloed because, you know, I'm in the morning slot and then you have, you know, different individuals on various times, you know, a lot of us talk to each other all the time. And I mean, I talk to Abe Hamilton all the time. You know, Tim and I have a text thread going, you know, all the time about what's going on in the world. And I just love being connected to so many different wonderful wonderful people at this ministry, and it's truly become a family for me. And it's wonderful, Chelsea, to hear you talk about your story as well. And thanks so much for joining. So again, you can go to afafoundation.net. That's afafoundation.net, or email foundation@afa.net if you'd like to learn more about what to give, how to give, and the charitable gift annuity. So really appreciate Chelsea Wildman's time this morning. And in the last few minutes here, I also wanted to cover one story that you may not have heard about. You should be following me on X, because then you would have heard about this days ago, even before Daily Wire, but that's okay. So Gavin Newsom has signed a bill banning school districts from alerting parents to their child's gender identity issues. I mean, this is just a perfect example of the extreme left that believes fundamentally that children belong to the state instead of parents. That is what this legislation is further evidencing. Because on Monday, Gavin Newsom, who's a California Democrat governor, signed into law legislation making his state the first in the nation to ban school districts from alerting parents of their children's preferred sexualities, coming from Daily Wire, or if they use pronouns or have adopted gender identities that conflict with those on their school records. The bill would prohibit school districts, county offices, education and charter schools, and the state special schools and members of a governing board, so basically anyone, from enacting or enforcing any policy, rule, or administrative regulation that requires an employee or even a contractor to disclose any information related to a pupil's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression to any other person, including their own parents, without the pupil's consent, unless otherwise required by law. So this is Assembly Bill 1955 that states LGBTQ plus peoples have the right to express themselves freely at school without fear, punishment, or retaliation, including what teachers or administrators might out them, quote unquote, out them without their permission. And so this, as Matt Walsh posted this morning, the other thing about this that nobody is really considering is that LGBTQ plus youth have a higher statistical probability or possibility of suicidal thoughts and self-harm. And so this is preventing the people most important in their life, their parents, from even knowing that they are now in this category. And of course, this is also attempting to allow indoctrination at school without parents' consent or knowledge, so that teachers can continue to make suggestive comments. And we all know how this works through the curriculum, even though the left denies that it happens. And the bottom line here is that we are in a culture war. We are here not just for the soul of America and, you know, freedom and liberty and the blessings of liberty and all of those things, but what liberty actually means on a day-to-day basis for your own family. And if you are listening from California, I would strongly encourage you to get your kids out of public schools at all costs. Whatever the cost is, there is nothing more important than ensuring that you have your parental rights intact. And this bill absolutely diminishes that, and in some cases is foreclosing that with respect to a very important issue. And there is no justification for California furthering this type of legislation that is advancing this secular Marxist notion that, you know, as Hillary Clinton said, you know, takes a village. And the left is increasingly saying, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have said very specifically, that children belong to the state. And this is one next huge step for California, and probably other blue states will contemplate this as well if their state legislatures are as wicked and just downright contemplating evil like the California General Assembly. But this is why it matters, and why, you know, we're talking so much about the presidential election in a presidential year, but the states matter. And every state matters. And this is why, even though largely the pro-life debate is now at the state level, because likely there's not going to be a consensus in Congress on some kind of abortion restriction, they can legislate according to the 14th Amendment. There can be a contemplation on a constitutional amendment for a for human life and a human life amendment, which I strongly support. We need to be 100% pro-life. But all of these things just show that we cannot only look to the federal government. The states really matter. And in the wake of all of this and this specific legislation, Elon Musk, who is a parent himself and, you know, certainly not in accordance with the biblical worldview on everything, but he takes his role as a father very seriously, has said he's moving X out of California. He's basically not doing business with California anymore. And has announced that just yesterday. That's the right move. It is the right move to say if you are a family in California, or if this legislation is anywhere else, I would suggest seriously contemplate moving. I mean, the worst thing that would happen is that you are beholden to a state and under their jurisdiction fighting for your child when you have an opportunity right now to make sure that you are protecting them. And anywhere that you're listening, if your kids, your grandkids, if you are an auntie like me and you have, you know, nephews and nieces that you care about, encourage them to homeschool. If you are a parent that has any opportunity to homeschool, parental rights are so incredibly important. That is the greatest gift that my parents gave me, was to homeschool me for the purpose of Christian discipleship. And yes, we learned, you know, math, reading, all of that kind of stuff too. But the main goal of homeschooling is so that you can actually be a parent and fulfill your role in training up a child in the way they should go, so when they're older, they will not depart from it. That's all the time we have for Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.